have caused a literal firestorm, and if we keep up the attention, I don't think that these people, small minds, will be allowed to own the solar system and prevent everybody from seeing what it is that NASA themselves asked to see, not once, not twice, but now at least three times. Actually, four if you count Bondurant's interview. What people can do is to continue to make phone calls to Dr. Brown's office at headquarters. They can also write to him, and that may even be better. It should be sent in terms of a copy, and copied at the bottom, to Chairman Robert A. Roe, R-O-E, who is our friend and colleague and an ally in the idea that we should know, we should be able to find out if there are intelligent artifacts on Mars. And he has said this in several different venues over the last year.
You did two series. You did UFOs, The Best Evidence, series number one. And then what was the second series?
Well, UFOs, The Best Evidence, ? Actually, that one is up for some awards coming up soon. It hasn't been determined yet whether that one will win. But the first one won an award from Associated Press. It was nominated. It was a finalist for an Emmy Award out here in the region that we're part of. And then it won an award from United Press International for individual achievement in the Western region. And then it won the national award a couple of weeks ago.
All right, so you were in Washington, D.C., accepting an award from United Press International and also the roundtable of your peers who judged your work, who said that not only are you a heck of a great journalist, but what you did obviously had value.
Well, it was amazing. I think a lot of these the journalists who kind of get in a staid kind of a frame of mind, take themselves maybe too seriously once in a while, were pretty amazed that a case could be made for this that wasn't based on wacko information and tabloid exaggerated stories of that nature. And they were surprised that you can actually take a serious look and find that there might be something to this stuff.
All right, now that you're saying there is a lot to the UFO and extraterrestrial thing, and you've won now awards from the media, Associated Press and United Press International, your second series is being considered for additional awards. Now tell us, I understand some other TV people are interested in what you've been doing. What's going on?
Well, as a matter of fact, there's a crew from ABC, the network, which is getting ready to produce its own program, something akin to NBC's Unsolved Mysteries. They're here today in Las Vegas, poking around to see if they can do their own version of what's been going on or what's been reported to be going on at Area 51 at Groom Lake here in Nevada, some of the stuff that Robert Lazar claimed was going on, specifically the testing of alien technology by government scientists here in the Nevada desert. ABC has caught wind of the story and are very much interested in producing a one-hour national look at this, say, the same kind of questions that we raised in our initial research. I think another indication of it is this article that was in Aviation Week and Space Technology a couple of weeks ago. This is the magazine that Phil Klass writes for, and it's really always had a dim view of UFOs and things of that nature, but it sent a team out here to run around in the desert and pursue these stories about things that look like flying saucers, strange craft, perhaps experimental craft, flying in the night sky that have been seen by so many people. They put some drawings in the article, and the drawings look remarkably like, A, they look remarkably like what Lazar said he had seen and had been working on, and B, they look remarkably like these ships that have been floating around Belgium. Now, you can look at it a couple of different ways. Either Aviation Week and the people it represents, it's very much tied into the military-industrial complex, either they're trying to explain away UFO sightings with these drawings of this experimental craft that supposedly belonged to our government, or B, perhaps it is a gradual release, again, to see on a broader scale if people would freak out. I find your thesis to be exciting. I hope it's true, and I can't wait.
My thesis?
Well, the thesis you're advancing here.
So that we're being warmed up.
Yeah.
Okay.
The most amazing thing happened yesterday evening. a courier drove up with a big silver bar. And it came from Jim Miller in Anchorage, Alaska. It is a 100-ounce, 100-troy-ounce bar of pure silver, 99.99. Yeah, it's already in a safe, don't worry. No, we're not going to keep it. We're going to give it away to any inventor or person that can bring us a working model of an end machine, but we're going to put an award program together on that. We don't have all the details, but certainly that'll be part of the award that we will give to somebody who can bring to us at the old Telford Hotel a working end machine. Jim Miller called today. He said, I hope that this silver bar will help start more than just the charge that comes with today's winter solstice. And it'll start, obviously, a change, he says. He wants people to be more reliant upon themselves, and I agree with him. So, Jim, thanks. The silver bar that you gave to us will be given as an award to whomever brings us the working end machine. There's one in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It's been on local TV.
Okay, is it still working?
Yeah.
Running itself?
Yep.
I haven't heard about that. That's strange. That is... Well,
we tracked it down. One of our listeners saw it on TV.
Uh-huh.
We tracked down the TV station in Tulsa, and we're now talking to the fellow who has it. So the technology is there, and that's why we printed the book, and that's why the book's available, okay? Say hello to Troy Reed. Troy, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Well, welcome to For the People. You are on the Sun Radio Network. You're on also an international broadcast station, Troy, which will put you around the world later on tonight. So there's a lot of people listening. You have invented a magnetic motor. I have the photographs of it. We have no pictures with radio, but suffice to say it's a rather straightforward and simple-looking device. You have a patent pending, is that correct?
Yes, I do.
All right. Can you tell us a little bit about your magnetic motor, what you envision, the sizes of it that can be made, what you have made, what kind of power it can put out, and so on and so forth? And let's start with, where did you get the idea?
Well, before I got the first idea, I want to thank the radio station to put me on this air and talk
sure.
about this. And another thing is, this was a God-given vision give to me, and it was about 2 years. It haunted me about 2 years, and until I did something about it. And now I had developed a four-cylinder magnetic motor, and that's not all the cylinders you can put on it. You can put 36 cylinders on it. You can build the motor as long as you want it to build. More injectors you put in it, more power you get from it. The motor that we had a meeting with Mike Sinar here in Tulsa. He seen it the night that we started it up. I lit a Christmas tree up. I ran a drill. I ran a fan. I ran a vacuum cleaner. And here you got all this extra energy sitting there not doing anything. So you can basically just hook anything you want up to it when you put it into an electric car.
So what you're saying is you've harnessed the power of permanent magnets. You've got permanent magnets arranged in a mechanical device so that they continue to keep the shaft turning. And that power from the output of this magnetic motor then can power a generator, and away you go.
Yes, sir. This motor that I've got, this prototype, is a 001, and the magnets in it weigh in the neighborhood around 300 pounds. And one magnet you can take and put it in your chest, and I can push you anywhere all over my yard with it. That's how strong it is. And it's a ceramic magnet that I have got into it. And the total of magnets that I've got in it, it's a 2x2 magnet. And I got the power from putting two magnets together, and that would be a total of 64 magnets in this magnetic motor. And it's just a motor that it's just hard to believe till you see it with your own eyes. And it will produce funnels of energy. The first time I fired it up, got it into 500 RPMs, and it blowed my injectors. And after that, I went back and made my injectors out of aluminum, and it's like I said, the motor is just, it's just hard to believe till you see it. And I end up with about 34 more volts than what I was really expecting out of the motor. I was expecting in the neighborhood of 24 more volts. That's all I was shooting for. But when I end up with 34 more volts into this motor that it produced out, I was really excited about it, and I was so excited about it, it kind of made me sick of my stomach.
Yeah. Okay, now, do you are you able to run one of these things, like, around the clock?
I have before. I have ran one for 2 weeks, and it runs 24 hours a day, and really there's no maintenance on this motor. It doesn't create no heat, and where you wear your bearings and stuff out is where you get a heat problem onto it, and there's where you get things galled up in motors and stuff is because you got heat, and this here does not have heat. It doesn't use water. It doesn't it doesn't even produce air.
Mm-hmm. Now, how many units have you made?
This here, the largest one I've got right now is about maybe 6.5 feet tall, maybe 7 feet. It weighs in the neighborhood around 450 pounds, maybe 500 pounds. And it would produce enough electricity to run your home.
All right, hang on if you would, Troy Reed, don't go away. For the People continues, Richard Hoagland is standing by, Chuck Arter saying more to come. It works, you've been on TV with it, you have a unit now that can generate enough power for to light up the average home. What are you going to do now?
I am waiting on a person out there to really want to get involved with this magnetic motor, and it's the most unique engine that the Earth has ever seen, and it's just something that you won't have to worry about polluting the whole world, the messing up the ozone. And if anyone out there is listening to this, this motor is a miracle motor, and that's what a man named it in a way. He stood there and he said, really, the only thing I can say that this motor is a miracle motor. And he said, it's hard to believe about this motor till you see it with your own eyes. And once you see it running, it just makes chills go up your back.
How would you want them to get in touch with you? Do you want people to...
They could write to Reed Magnetic Motor Incorporated.
Mm-hmm.
Mailing address is P.O. Box 70395, Tulsa, Oklahoma, 74170. And I will respond to their mailing to me, and I would even mail them a brochure, and it would explain the motor to them. And if people would like to come to me, to come in personally and talk to me, I'll talk to them. And it would be hard for them to see this with their own eyes. There's a lot of engineers have seen this, and they have actually lost sleep.
Troy, all I can tell you is that you're going to be a very, very wealthy man, and that's delightful. I hope that when you do get a chance to get these things in production, you get one for our lobby here, because we have a...
Yeah, that would be nice. And let me say this. Where in the world could you go you can put this in an electric car, and it'll charge all the batteries up you want, and you had a car setting up where it was so cold, you would never have to worry about going out and scraping your windows in a car, because this thing would keep your car warm all night long. And if you got anything that you need to plug up on the outside while that motor's sitting there running in your automobile, it runs 24 hours a day. You can plug an extension cord to it and run your lights outside. If you got a failure in your house, you got a big storm tears your house up and it doesn't bother your car. And you're...
Hang on a minute. This is too good to be true, but I have a feeling it is. Troy Reed, stand by. I would imagine that this thing is so simple, I'm looking at it, that a machine shop could probably turn one out. Their very first model could be turned out in a couple of days. I would imagine that once somebody figured out how to do this thing on an assembly line basis, my guess is this thing could be built for well less than $100 at retail. Would you not think so?
Well, let me go back on this. This motor can actually be built out of plastic. They've got plastics of the day that will create a lot of strength. This motor can be built out of fiberglass. So you can actually get the weight down by going into a company. And the most the most expense that you've got is your magnets. But if you buy a group, a big, large sum of magnets, then you produce your money problems down there.
Mm-hmm. You take care now, and we'll be back in touch. All right. Well, Richard, what do you think?
Fascinating.
That neat stuff?
It's obvious that the Troy is a hands-on, do-it-yourself engineer type.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that he wasn't answering the questions I asked is not because he didn't want to. It's because I don't think he thinks that way.
Mm-hmm.
There's obviously someone who is not theory-oriented. He's hands-on-oriented. And however he came to this intuition, this idea, it's obvious to me that what he was saying was that the power out is a function of how fast you rotate it.
Yep.
No, the physics, you know, is dependent upon the angular momentum. And it's also dependent upon how big. And what he was giving me there, I would estimate that he's getting a few kilowatts out, max. All right?
Well, out of that particular size.
Particular size. And when he says that you put in stronger springs, it rotates faster, you get more power out, that, of course, squares exactly with what we found with the Diploma technologies. What we're looking at here, I think, and again, I must caution everyone that I've not seen the diagrams, I've not seen the device, I've only heard it explained. But what I think we're seeing here is another road to Rome. We're looking at another way to tap into end space,
mm-hmm.
which has unlimited energy if you open the gate, if you create a device that opens that you know, interconnection between the two dimensions, you know, four space and three space, you're going to get power, and you're going to get it out in the form of electrical energy if you design the right gadget on this side, which is what, I guess, the Reed magnetic motor is a variant thereof.
So obviously, we've got the big lie, and like so many other government lies, and gosh, I can remember all the things that NASA told us. They told us the Hubble telescope would work, if you remember. One of two things has either occurred. Either the Hubble telescope does work, and they want time to fool with it and not tell anybody, or the Hubble telescope doesn't work. Either way, they're lying. Correct?
Yes, it appears it's not working too well.
Okay, but the point of it is whether it is or it isn't, okay? They first tell us, they told us it would and didn't, which means somebody screwed up and covered it up. And, you know, I get all of these problems where they tell us that the shuttle is safe, and then, of course, we had the Challenger blow up. We just can't really trust the U.S. government like we would like to trust them because of, in my opinion, all the different bureaucracies and the egos. But about a year ago, we had a visit from Bettina Gregory, senior correspondent for ABC Television. Todd Easton was the producer. They came to visit us when we were at Cedar Key. We did a program on the trouble people were having with the credit bureaus and inaccurate credit reporting. They videotaped us. They were there for a week, by the way. This was a very long tour. They had done research with us, and we talked to them prior and what have you. In a nutshell, they put together a report about the travesty of poor credit information reporting and how it was really hurting a lot of people in America, and how the consumer was arguing against a stacked deck whenever they tried to get their credit report corrected. And of course, I even had firsthand information because I had a file folder full of what I went through, and I knew what I was doing. The point I'm trying to say is they then went to TRW and they went to Equifax, which are spin-offs of giant corporations, and they tried to interview them and they got a stone wall. They put the report together, and it was a very, very well-done piece, 2 or 3, 4 minutes, whatever. They even had footage of Cedar Key and how pretty it was, and it closed with a fisherman, and, you know, it was really a nice piece. They sent it up to New York. It was cleared in Washington. They sent it up to New York. And the New York higher-ups saw the piece, apparently got some kind of input from ABC, from TRW or Equifax or somebody, okay? And they killed the report. What I heard was going to happen is, and I heard this through the grapevine, was that they were going to treat you kind of like a Percival Lowell. a real nice guy who's trying real hard, but gee, oh golly gosh.
Well, that was the other thing that was disturbing when I talked to the director. He said he had been given specific instructions from headquarters to play up the Lowell angle, to make me look like Percival Lowell, who, of course, is the early 20th century astronomer who built the Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff, who founded basically the planetary science, the planetary astronomy, and who thought there were canals on Mars, which the Viking and Mariner missions have now proved to be false. Yeah, you're right. Nice guy, but he's deluded, so we don't have to pay attention. What is disturbing is that all this is being done after the fact. Normally, when you do an interview, the producers do simultaneous interviews where you are allowed to see what the other guy is going to say, and they're allowed to see what you're going to say, and everybody has a chance to answer each other's points simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, the audience, the viewers, if they ever put this thing on the air, will see my comments taped 9 months ago, and they will see the planetary scientist who has now requested all 2.5 hours of the interview. A transcript has been typed up, and all of the outtakes, all of the things that are not in the show, they are going to be shown, including a transcript of the script, and an actual tape of the finished production as of 2 weeks ago, and I will have a chance to see nothing that they're going to say, nor do I have a right in the show, apparently, to answer their comments, and of course, this is rather unfair. They will see statements by myself, and then they will see statements contradicting what I've said by members of the planetary science community, the scientists who took the pictures, and they will not see me answering the specific charges, therefore, the charges will go unanswered, and they will be assumed to be true. Charges that are unanswered are charges that are believed, and the charge in this case that I will not have a chance to answer is simply that the NASA scientists who took these pictures have never done a damn thing with them for 15 years. There have been no analyses, no programs, no memos, no papers, no anything. And we found this out through the Freedom of Information Act, but the scientists sitting on camera will come across as if they have, with their enormous NASA budgets, looked at every single frame, given them exhaustive analyses, and, you know, dear Richard is being deluded like Percival Lowell, end of serious discussion. And that, of course, we cannot allow to stand. See, what has happened is, from our inside sources, and there are a lot of people now in the agency calling me up because, frankly, and this is a direct quote from one of them last Friday, this is a tragedy. You are being fried. You are being made a martyr for something that is much bigger than individual personalities. The issue, is there life on Mars? Are there artifacts? The original game plan from these sources was to deep fix the program. Hoagland's Mars, as of 2 weeks ago, was not going to see air. Then, literally, thousands of people from your audience and others have called Dr. Brown and NASA headquarters and Bob Rose committee, and they have made it known that the will of the American people is, for God's sake, show us what is there. So the game plan was switched as of last week, and now it is to put the program on, but distorted in such a way that the subject looks silly. We do not have a chance to answer specific accusations or charges about our work, about the numbers, about the science. And the end point will be that people will see that this is a tempest in a teapot, and we're nice but deluded, and they'll move on to more important things. It is media manipulation, pure and simple. We are looking into the legal strategies because we've had a couple of attorneys come forth who have kind of offered their services and said, you know, this is so grossly unfair and so un-American and so against the First Amendment, considering not even the importance of the subject, but just decency, just common ordinary decency, that here's what we think you should be thinking about doing. So we're investigating the legal positions and stance that we should take vis-a-vis airing a program with my name on it that is not really a representation fair of our own work. That's item number one. Item number two, I've had a couple of producers who have, you know, now heard about this potential debacle, tell me that in any fair treatment of the subject, what they should do is to air the original program, which is basically finished. And then if the planetary scientists want to have an answer, a rebuttal, they should produce a second program, which is the answer to Hoagland's Mars and to the intelligence hypothesis, and they should present their best case, their best evidence for why what we're saying is not there. But to do it all in one show, to cut it all apart, to re-edit and make it look as if we all are having a simultaneous conversation when they'll be separated by 9 or 10 months, that is the grossly manipulative part, to say the least. Well, the issues here are as big as anything that we have considered. I mean, it now really is becoming more and more obvious that if there was no smoke here, there would be no fire, and the question is, why are they afraid to simply let the data stand on its own?
Well, let me ask you a question. What happens when we go back and they take pictures again, and the artifacts are there, and this time you see them closer?
Well, see, this is what has me very concerned, and a number of other members of the project, because if we cannot trust headquarters to equitably adjudicate a program discussion of the issues, the data we currently have, how can we trust these people to live up to their word to Bob Rowe, to the House Committee, to the American people, to take new pictures and to show us what they find when they find it in 1993? If the planetary scientists, to quote Frank Owen, are up in arms and adamant that this discussion will not air, these are the guys who are in charge not only of the old Viking images, but also of the Mars Observer pictures to come down in 1993. How can we trust them to show us what they find? This has very, very serious implications, given that we're not discussing bread in a breadbasket. We're discussing potential artifacts of another civilization lying right next door that could have radical changes in terms of terrestrial history if it is verified. And all we have been asking from the beginning is to give this data a fair hearing, go back and get new data, and resolve the issue. What is so unfair about that?
Well, what's unfair about that is that they are all suffering from what is called the not invented here syndrome, which means that they didn't discover it, they didn't popularize it, they didn't get any of the limelight for it, and because they did not get any of the gold or the frosting, their egos prevent them from allowing somebody else to do so.
Well, there have been some people who said now that this new strategy has been revealed, and again, it's because the inside people are talking. They are. One of them said, he said, I am sick to my stomach to see what is happening with this. The strategy has changed. The strategy has gone from simple throwing it in the ash can to manipulating a program that has no resemblance to the original production that Dr. Bondurant and his colleagues produced at NASA Lewis. Obviously, this has gone so far now that it raises serious questions regarding, in my mind, the usefulness of some kind of congressional inquiry. It might be useful for people to think about that and to think about putting that in the form of a letter request both to NASA and to the committees. Remember, Bob Rowe and his committee are interested in this subject. They are on the side of finding out. They deserve to know what is now being done in their name in terms of a government agency.
Okay, one quick question. When will this this aborted program be on the air?
Well, there's a lot of stuff to wade through. I mean, they have now asked, headquarters has asked, for a complete transcript of the 2.5-hour interview that Dr. Bondurant did with me.
So you're saying it's not going to be this week?
It's not this week. It could be months.
Okay. All right. Richard, thank you very much for a sudden, quick appearance on the program. And we'll be talking again later this week.
People should remember that the addresses to write are Dr. Bob Brown, who's director of education, NASA headquarters, 400 Maryland Avenue Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20546.
Okay, Richard.
And any copies of correspondence to Bob Rowe at the House Committee.
Okay.
Richard, when do you think the science community and the U.S. government will ever tell us what's going on out there at Area 51?
Well, of course, this is not my area of expertise. I'm looking a bit beyond Area 51. Look, my bottom line is the UFO confusion, duplicity, political quagmire, the public relations quicksands of UFO sightings and witnesses and government accusations and MJ-12 with that whole nine yards will never be resolved. It is literally irresolvable unless this government decides to come clean with information that it has. However, in 1993, in August, with the clock ticking, even as we speak, a spacecraft will take a set of crystal clear photographs of a set of ruins on another planet that stands still, whose latitude and longitude we know, and whose existence is now being valiantly covered up by your friendly local neighborhood space agency. Otherwise, why all the fuss over the NASA briefings and releasing that video of the production that they had in the works for 9 months. If we keep their feet to the fire, ultimately, if there is something at Groom Lake, if they have been testing things, if there have been deals with other people, all this stuff will come out of the closet once it is proven, date certain, that there are extraterrestrial civilizations, and one of them left artifacts of inestimable importance right next door. That's where I'm putting my money, my energies, my focus, and that's where I would suggest a lot of people look, because that's the one thing they cannot cover up. You can't hide a whole planet in the solar system.
All right. Richard, if NASA doesn't transmit the program, how long will it take you and your associates to get something put together on tape?
We are having conversations this very afternoon after I leave your program on that subject. And I may have some numbers for you by next week.
Okay.
It will not be long.
All right. But we also understand that there are some other craft that are being tested in Area 51. According to a lot of people who live out there, that simply didn't come from here.
Okay, and these are supposed to be craft that can make right-angle turns that...
Yeah, but they're not from here, man. We didn't make them.